Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Welcome to Hollywood and Levine. I am Ken Levine, your podcast host. This is part two of my two-part interview with writer Robin Schiff. Now, Robin wrote Romy and Michelle's High School Reunion. She also co-created Almost Perfect with me and David Isaacs. She's been on a lot of other shows, and currently she's the executive producer of Emily in Paris. And she wrote this document, Advice for Writers, along with some book recommendations. It's really, really terrific. This is part two, as I mentioned, and if you missed part one, after you listen to this, go back and check that out as well. Some great advice, some great books that she recommends, and it's really a terrific episode. So here we go, part two with Robin Schiff right here on Hollywood and Levine. Here's a book I have read, Hitchcock Truffaut.
One of the best books on movie making ever.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Two geniuses. And it's fascinating reading. You know, it doesn't feel like you're reading a textbook at all. It's just fascinating.
No, and he invented the term MacGuffin, which he explains in detail in this book. And but I love also the conversation about the difference between surprise and suspense. And surprise is when the audience is in the dark, and suspense is when the audience knows something that the protagonist doesn't know, or you know something's going to happen, but you don't know when. Is that about right, Ken?
That's exactly right.
He did suspense. He was a master of suspense, not surprise. Although there was a big surprise or a shock, I guess, in Psycho.
Psycho, sure.
But he did a lot of suspense. But the other thing is, it's making me think of the comedy version of this, which is, how much do you let the audience, like, we always have these discussions, if the audience knows something that the main characters don't, but they're still excited, does it make them look like idiots? Or is it fun for the audience to see people be excited when we know it's only a matter of time before they find out it's going to shit? And I kind of like to know.
Oh, I think it's the latter. And a few weeks ago, when I dissected the new Frasier and I talked about farces and the fact that the audience has to know the truth for the farce to work. So, yes, I'm a fan of the audience knowing. Also, if you're doing misdirection, where two characters are talking and one character thinks they're talking about yoga and the other character thinks he's talking about sex, and the dialogue could go either way, it's fun for the audience if the audience knows what's going on.
Yeah.
You mentioned Robert McKee. Now, he has a book, and he also, for those who are not familiar, he has done these weekend seminars for probably 30 years now.
Is he still doing them?
I don't know. I never took it. The problem to me with the Robert McKee seminar is he tries to turn every movie into one fundamental structure. He tries to turn every movie into Casablanca. And I remember at the time when it was the rage that we would get notes from network executives and they would be talking about the quarter point suspense stake or what, Robert McKee glossary terms, and you go, okay, all right, she went to the seminar, now she thinks she knows story.
I just, again, I file that under stimulation. I took the weekend. I don't slavishly adhere to anything other than if I'm bored, then the audience is definitely going to be bored too. You better be interested in what you're writing about and engaged in it.
Okay, other books you talk about, William Goldman's Adventures in the Screen Trade. I've read that too. Great book. And that's really, well, there's some talk about actual writing, but it's more an overview of Hollywood. You know, I should read it again because I wonder how much of it still applies. You
I
know,
bet
it's a different
none of it
marketplace, it's a
applies.
different
Oh my
world.
God, this is such a different world. I mean, I don't think these people know what the hell is going on.
Mark Norman, What Happens Next? I never heard of that one.
I read it when it came out. Don't ask me for a summary.
Okay.
But I liked it enough to put it on the list. And then the Billy Wilder interviews with Cameron Crowe.
Read
You
that. That's
cannot go
great.
wrong with that. You cannot go wrong with that.
So you have other suggestions. When you are stuck, walk or move around. And boy, that's what I do. I will stop in the middle of a sentence if I'm stuck, and I'll just go off and do something else.
Interesting, because I do this the Don Roos thing, and we'll talk about that, right? The kitchen thing. Yeah, I do that, so I'll talk about that later, but I will just sit there. But if at the end of an hour I'm stuck, at that point I will walk.
See, my feeling, at least this is what works for me, is that if I'm stuck and I just walk away and maybe take a shower or go to sleep and wake up in the morning when I'm just kind of refreshed and I let my mind riff, I'll usually come up with the solution. You know, that you kind of let your subconscious work on it. Which to me is a lot better than just sitting in a room staring at the page. Now, when you're in a writer's room, and again, you don't go home until the script is finished, you don't have that option.
Yep. But we're not, the show I'm on now is a single camera show. So unless it's your episode, we keep normal hours.
Normal hours on a television show. And you call your and you call yourself a writer?
10:30 till 6.
Wow. And you get to go to Paris to do it.
I do.
You say if you're struggling to begin, start with the scene that you picture most clearly. So like even if it's in the middle of the movie or whatever.
What Ken, you referred to the voice earlier, and we know that the voice means how does the what's the tone of the whole movie, and beyond that, the voice is everyone has a voice. How do they speak? How does this person sound versus that person? So start with anything that seems easy. Anything where you picture it at all, because then you'll use it when you get there. Or if you can start, let's say you see the last third of your movie most clearly, write that because you're going to start getting ideas because it's the law, the physics law of inertia. A body at rest remains at rest. A body in motion remains in motion. And just see, that's almost like the opposite of what helps you, Ken.
Yeah, I guess so. But in a sense,
Really, not really. It's
my
your
brain
fight
is still
for
working.
inertia. Yes.
My
Yes.
brain is still working.
And literally, your getting away from the inertia. So no, I take back what I say vigorously.
You say, read as many screenplays and TV scripts as you can. Always a great idea.
Always a great idea, and only do the shows you admire. I don't think you have anything to gain by, looking at shows that aren't state of the art. I like to take a lot of classes, and even though I didn't want to be an actor, being in the Groundlings changed my life. I learned about comedy. I highly recommend, if she's teaching, Linda Barry, the comic. Not comic, she's writes comics. Lynda Barry, and she's amazing. But that's about tapping into your creativity, which I think is important. It's almost like an athlete staying tuned. You want to, if you do this over time, how do you stay connected? You just
Yeah,
have
and
to do
that's what
stuff.
inspires me is I'll read a screenplay I really admire, or I'll watch a show or a movie that I absolutely love. And it just kind of reminds me of why I'm doing this.
And the Writers Guild Library has a lot of stuff. I would recommend that you look at screenplays that you like, but sometimes they have work in progress, the writer's notes. If you're a Romy and Michelle fan, I think I left them a bunch of notes of the work in progress, if anybody gives a shit. But I know they have a lot of stuff that they collect there, and you can get it for free. And I bet you can get just about anything on the
They do
internet.
pretty much have everything. Yeah, you can go and you can read our scripts, people. You can read our aftermath scripts. You mentioned that you always outline. I do too.
I've been working on a beat sheet. I'm re-outlining this movie, the epic sequel. I'm just doing a beat sheet, and I am already at 11 pages.
Yeah, it for me it helps to know where I'm going. You also say that you use colored 3x5 cards
Yeah, I
so that
love
you can
that.
move things around. I never do that.
I do different things depending on my state of mind. If I know that I have certain scenes that I want, but I don't know exactly where they're going to go, it's such a hassle to move stuff around in an outline that I take a Sharpie, I use different colored 3x5 cards, and I just write, the sort of minimum that you need to write to remind you what the scene is. And then I have a big dining room table, and I lay out the cards. But I can see, where is Romy? Where's Michelle? How many scenes are they in separately? I don't want them in a lot of scenes separately. And I can see it just by looking visually.
You also say when someone asks you to give feedback on their work, ask them specifically what it is they're looking for. And boy, I do that too, because look, there are some people that come to you for feedback and basically they just want you to say how great their work is.
Or give it to your agent. That's their fantasy, that you're just going to go, this is a work of genius that must be shared with the world. Let me urgently have my agent read it. And that really rarely happens. And I wrote this whole document to begin with because I don't want to mentor that many people. I've mentored so many people over the years, but I do want to help people. That's a whole other thing. So, to me, there's some good advice in here, even if we don't become best buddies.
Okay, you write, how do you know if you should keep struggling or stick with or abandon an idea? You say you need a core of connection. What is a core of connection?
It's that part of you that was sure at some point. I compare it to like a time when you fell in love and you knew you were in love with that person. And then many years later, you go through like kind of a shitty time. You at least can go back and go, I know what it feels like to love this person. And I know they have these qualities, and I'm going to look for those qualities again. So you go back to the beginning of it to see what it was that attracted you. And if you're not connecting with it, then yeah, it's probably not something you should stick with. You know, but I've gone through the most interesting thing on this sequel. I've been writing this for 18 months, and the studio hasn't seen it. I'm doing my third version of the script, and I'm so proud of myself because I was having so much trouble with it. Doing what you were saying, you know, connect, what is their voice at 50 something? The movie means too much to me to do kind of a shitty facsimile, but there, I just was struggling, and I stuck with it. And I got lucky, someone gave me an idea that really unlocked a lot of things for me. But I can't believe I stuck with it. I can't believe it. And you know what my motivation is, Ken?
What's your motivation? Money?
I want that money.
Yeah, right.
But
That's our motivation for everything.
seriously, folks, it's
Yeah.
not worth, for me, it's not worth doing this unless I think it's good. It really is, and I don't want to disappoint fans. And
Yeah, I guess for you, there's sort of the added pressure
yeah.
from the fact that the movie is still so popular today.
Yep.
Well, you know what? That's a pressure I would gladly take.
It's a pressure that I'm fine with. I was just recently, they did the Hollywood Forever Cemetery, does these screenings, and there were 4,000 people there, you know, and 90% of them were young and they were wearing costumes, and it was so cool. And the movie's 25 years old.
Yeah, well, it was a cultural phenomenon.
It really wasn't, though. It built over years, you know. But that's why I'm looking at this going, how do you know if you should keep struggling and stick? I was just ready to throw in the towel on this thing, but I couldn't. I
You
could
know
not.
what? You were that way with the first one too, because we were doing Almost Perfect while you were doing the finishing touches, and you were going, I don't know, is this any good? And we were going, this is very funny. This is very funny. You're going, oh God, I don't know. Is anybody going to care? Are these people too stupid? And we're, no, it works. It's funny. Yeah.
Yeah, I had the last minute jitters because honestly, I was doing something that was original. So I had no way of knowing, was it going to click with anybody?
Right.
Was it going to resonate with anybody? So it's, you know, it's a surprise to me too.
You alluded to it earlier, the kitchen timer, which is a way of structuring your writing day, which was created by this writer, Don Roos. Tell us a little bit about the kitchen timer.
All righty. John Roos wrote Single White Female, and he wrote a really funny, wonderful movie with Lisa Kudrow and Christina Ricci and some other people called The Opposite of Sex. So he's a writer I very much admire, but he has this system that he uses when he writes where he uses a kitchen timer. It doesn't literally have to be a kitchen timer, it can be the timer on your phone. But the principle of the kitchen timer is that every writer deserves a definite and doable way of being and feeling successful every day. So rather than judging the quality of your work or even the quantity of your work, you evaluate how you did that day by whether or not you showed up. And you work in two documents. You set the kitchen timer for an hour. Don likes to decide on Monday how many hours of writing we will do on Tuesday. And then, you'll do between 1 and 4 hours. Obviously, you can do more than four if you want, but between 1 and 4 is fine. And then for the hour, you can't go online, you can't take phone calls, no snacks, go to the bathroom before your hour starts. And you work in two documents. One is the writing document, and the other is like a journal. And the journal, you can write things. I mean, I have stuff from the first movie where I would write stuff like, I'm so hungry. Why didn't I eat anything before I started writing? I suck. If I didn't suck, why am I thinking about what I want to eat? Maybe Romy and Michelle don't know what they want to eat. Oh, now I have an idea for Romy and Michelle, and then you go over to Romy and Michelle. And then if you hit a wall with that, you can go back into your writing journal. But the idea is to spend the hour writing, even if you spend the hour writing in your writing journal. And this is another way that you, as Don says, when in doubt or under pressure or self-attack, we choose fewer hours rather than more. A good, strong beginning is 1 hour a day. So a lot of this that you and I have talked about has to do with just that part of us where, we're creating something from nothing. We're making it up. And there's no way to know if it's going to be good when we're starting it. I mean,
Right.
maybe David Kelly knows or Aaron Sorkin. I don't know. But a lot of these things are good ways to bypass your self-judgment and your self-criticism and things that stop you from doing the thing, from starting with the confusion and being able to tolerate the confusion so you can get to it being better.
Well, one thing when I'm writing something on my own, it's always in my mind. And there's times when I'll be going, should I go to the movies tonight? Or should I want to get that scene done by the weekend. And if you do this kitchen timer program, it frees you of that. Because you have your hour or 2 hours or whatever it is, and when the 2 hours are over, then you're
You're
done for
done.
the day. Go off and do whatever you want.
And not only that, Ken, let's say the day before you decide, I want to write 4 hours tomorrow. You can write for an hour in the morning, then you go to the gym, then you write for another hour, you go out to lunch, and then you write for 2 hours. Or you discover I'm best in the morning, so you write 4 hours, from 8 a.m. till noon, and you're done for the rest of the day. But it's what I think is ingenious about it is you know when you're starting and you know when you're stopping, and but it's all about writing and takes the pressure off. Is it good? Is it not good? Did I do enough pages? And I do find that when I'm writing in the journal, not always, but a lot of times I'll get ideas for the project I'm working on.
Do you ever go back and look at old journals and go, was I on LSD? What was I thinking here?
My old journals make me feel like I was the most shallow person in the history of the planet. All I cared about was I going to be successful as a writer and my weight, how much I weighed, how much less I should be eating. I'm just seem insipid, just insipid. So I, needless to say, I have not saved my journals. I got rid of it. I at one point I thought, oh, I'm going to do a one woman show, and I'd save these tapes from going to psychics and astrologers over a period of 30 years. So I thought I'll listen to these tapes and I'll put together kind of like a fun journey through 30 years. And again, it was like, am I going to be successful in my career? What's going to happen with this project? Blah, blah. You know, I just, it was just shut up. You know, I didn't want to do a show where people were thinking about me. Just shut up already. There were a few good things in there, but mostly I'm happy to destroy the tapes.
I'd want to see him sometimes. See, I've had the advantage of being in a room with you for 2 years, so I've heard some of these stories, and they're
Yeah.
probably way more entertaining than you think.
Well, I hope so, because I've told them enough over the years.
Well, Robin, this has been great. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Have fun in Paris.
You made me feel so good that you like this document, Ken, because I do respect you so much as a writer. And I hope this is helpful to people who are listening.
I'm sure it will be. Thanks, Robin.
Bye-bye.
And that's Robin Schiff. And her advice and her book recommendations are thanks to Robin. Really good stuff, don't you think? Anyway, our thanks, as always, to Adam and Susie Meister-Butler, Howard Hoffman, John Wolford, Bruce, and Jason Miller. My email address, should you wish to contact me, is hollywoodlevine@outlook.com. That's hollywoodlevine@outlook.com. Follow me on Instagram, Hollywood and Levine, and you can see all of my New Yorker cartoons. See you again next week, right here on
Hollywood and Levine.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.